What's going on, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the California Underground Podcast. I am your host, Phil, as well as with my trusty co-host, the best and fastest researcher in the West, Camille. And tonight, we are happy to have a very passionate political activist. You want to talk about deep behind enemy lines? Richie Greenberg is deep behind enemy lines and has been working, and he's been actually doing some great things. I started following him on Twitter not too long ago and have been loving everything he's been putting out. And I just reached out to him recently. I was like, hey, do you want to come on to the podcast? And he said, sure. And we already had an episode about how horrible and how bad things are going in San Francisco. He's based out of San Francisco. And here we are. And he's rocking the SF pin. He's ready to go. Richie, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. A pleasure to be invited. I really love basically to get the word out to as many people as possible. The way I look at it, it doesn't matter what the platform is. Doesn't matter how few or how many viewers there are. Doesn't matter if it's local or national or international, in print, on podcast, on live TV, recorded, radio, doesn't matter. There is a tremendous interest in San Francisco, and I'm happy to be part of it.
Awesome. So why don't you tell people a little bit about your resume, because I was reviewing your resume. You're very active. You've worn several different hats. Most recently, you were also involved in the recall of Chesa Boudin, which was a huge win. I don't think anyone expected that to actually happen in San Francisco, made it happen. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and what you've been up to?
So interestingly enough, I was born in Queens, New York, and then grew up on Long Island and left when I had just barely 21 years old. And I moved to the West Coast because that's what, you know, the coolest people did is they moved to California. You know, back in New York, the East Coast, you put up with moving around to other East Coast or Northeast cities, you know, Boston, maybe New Jersey, Washington, and or down south to the Carolinas or into Florida. But I wanted to go to school and live in California. And at that time, it was difficult. You had to pay per minute on the phone long distance, and you try and get a long distance calling plan. You didn't have cell phones. We barely even had fax machines, I think, at that point. Yeah. I mean, we're talking a couple of decades back. So I moved to Los Angeles, and I was living, if you know, or if listeners know about Southern California, I went to Cal State Fullerton. And I was living in Whittier and La Habra Heights, and had a lot of friends in that area there. And I studied business law, and actually I took a few courses in criminal justice as well. And so I was like a Southern California transplant. And as a result of being there, that's pretty much why I lost my New York accent. So if I really strain it, you could hear it, but my attitude is still sort of there. But you know, growing up in New York, it toughened me as a person, and wanting to fight for your beliefs and to recognize BS. Can we use profanity on this podcast if we want to, or
sure.
No? Okay, bullshit instead of BS. Okay, but even the mayor, San Francisco mayor on CNN the other night said bullshit, and they let that go through. So I can spot bullshit. I can spot when someone is being manipulative or exploitive. That was. And to immediately call someone out on it. And that's why that's like a New York kind of attitude. And I still have that. It was suppressed for a while, but now it's back after moving here to San Francisco. But moving from Los Angeles, and I lived in a few other cities and states for a year here, a year there, including towards the end of the 90s, I was in South Dakota. I lived there for a couple of years, and I even had a home that I was renovating in North Dakota. So I know both the most urban cities of San of the United States to know what it's like to be in a real urban environment, and then also in extreme rural northern plains within an hour or two of the border of Canada. So it's very cold there. So then I moved here to San Francisco. I've been here for 22 years, approximately. And I have, over the years, been a business startup consultant, not the big tech companies, but just small mom and pop shops and online things. And, you know, really get to know a person as a consultant, but almost like a friend as well. So I have that ability to get the rapport, to talk with people, to see what their needs are, what their concerns are, to see what's important and what's not important, and how we can make the best of anything, you know, whatever they want to do, whether it's in business or elsewhere. So living here in San Francisco, I arrived here just after 9/11 in 2001. Have been here ever since. And I didn't really pay that much attention to politics at that point. It's a new city. I wanted just to explore. I wanted to see where I fit in. There were niches, the kind of people that are out there, attitudes, restaurants, what's fun to do. And it wasn't really until about 8 years ago that I started feeling that there's big problems here, and it's because of the government. It's not us. It's not my friends. It's not my associates. It's not my clients. It's not the neighbors. It's the government. And they're the ones that are creating all these crazy ideas and proposals and policies. And I started paying attention more and more. And then in late 2015, I decided to throw my hat in and start exploring different political clubs that were around the city, attend community meetings, learn who's who, take a lot of notes. And then in 2018, I was already, at that point, I was already pretty involved with the Republican Party at that, back in at that point, which some people are like, what are you talking about? Yes. There's about 30,000, 32,000 registered Republicans in San Francisco. And I went to the Republican Party's monthly meetings and quickly realized that they were very much the underdog. But I was, you know, it at that point seemed that that is where I fit in. And the thing to remember, though, is that this is the city SF GOP, not the state GOP, not the federal, not national RNC. It's city only. And I stuck with it. I ran for mayor. I decided I want to go ahead and try and make my mark on the city. I saw the opportunity because our then current Mayor Ed Lee, who was pretty well liked, and he was very moderate, centrist. He was a Democrat, as is everybody in elected office. And he suddenly had a heart attack late at night and died while shopping at one of those 24-hour supermarkets. He collapsed and died. And the next morning, I happened to have been in Sacramento on business, and I called back to some of the local San Francisco GOP leadership. And I said, I think that's a calling. I think that's a signal for me to take action personally. So while I was in Sacramento, I walked right into the state political affairs department, which is in the Secretary of State's office. And I filed the committee forms to open a committee to run for office. So I actually became the first candidate within hours of the mayor passing away. I filed the paperwork, and somehow that information got to local media here in San Francisco within within a half hour, I already was getting phone calls asking for interviews. So that was, so that was 2018. June 2018 was a special election. I actually ran against a few far leftist communist by candidates that were popular, that were known, as well as London Breed, who was our current mayor now. We were all, there were eight of us candidates, and we went to all the candidate forums and interviews and debates on stage throughout the city. And I sat right there, right next to London Breed, answering questions in front of a crowd and in front of the media. So that was a great experience. I didn't win. I had no chance of winning because the Democrat Party machine, the political machine that is so entrenched in San Francisco, and it's elsewhere, of course, I know, would never let an outsider win for the most part, and especially not someone who was from the SFGOP. So since then, I have left the party. I am independent right now, a lot more like towards libertarian is what seems a fit for me at this point. But right now, I don't need the labels, just like so many labels have been causing problems lately, you know, in politics, looking for the intersection and all this. So I am trying to avoid being labeled anything. It allows me then to comment and align with and be supportive or critical of anything and not have to toe the party line. So that brings you up to date for the most part, with the exception of my activism a year and a half, 2 years ago with recalling Tressa Bodine. And now I'm very active with trying to push back against the San Francisco version of the reparations plan. So those are the two things that are most I've had on my plate in the last year and a half or so.
It's as I hear your story, it actually reflects, I kind of identify with it. I'm from New Jersey.
Jersey, what exit? What exit?
Exit 12 off Route 80. See?
See?
East
yeah,
Coast.
There you go.
This is how we communicate. What exit it. You off of?
Yep, Jersey. Jersey.
Jersey. So the armpit.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and when I heard you were from Queens, I was like, oh, I hope he's not a Mets fan like me and suffers.
I am. I have a hat somewhere. Mets and Islanders and Jets.
Oh, that's a rough trio right there.
Yeah,
but,
it is.
You know, we understand each other. So if you can learn to deal with the disappointment of being a Mets fan, you can learn with the disappointment of working in California politics.
Yeah.
But so I definitely identify with your story about like moving from the East Coast to California, because there was this idea that California was sort of this land of milk and honey and opportunities, and it was new and you could experience new culture and just you could, it was different. It was different than the East Coast, and it's hard to really put it into words. It's just, you wanted to be somewhere out there. And when I first used to go to San Francisco in college, I loved it. I went to school up north. My grandfather used to live in San Francisco after World War II. He worked at Fort Mason down there, and his wife worked at the Presidio for a long time. Yeah, there was a magic quality about California. And that's why, to me, it hurts to see where San Francisco is right now and how absolutely overboard it's gone with its policies. Reparations being probably one of the most insane right now. Talk a little bit about the specifics of reparations, what they're proposing in San Francisco, because there was a state task force, but there was also a San Francisco task force, correct?
Yes, correct. You sure you want to go into this?
Absolutely. No, we've already done a whole episode, so let's go ahead and just jump into it.
I have been approached by several different members of the media, TV and other podcasts and written newspapers, and they all say that it is such a hot button, you know, third rail topic that most mainstream media doesn't even want to cover it. At least they don't want to cover the pushback to it. They are fearful, for whatever reason, that it has to be only reported in a positive light or sort of like the straight factual, like the committee suggests this, or the task force wants that amount, or this dollar amount. But they don't talk about the ramifications. They don't talk about the legality. And that's where I, from the start, said this just can't be lawful. It can't be constitutional. That's mostly the how I'm coming at this, right? So a couple of months ago, when here in San Francisco with their version, it came out of summer of 2020, when the country was all in the throes of COVID lockdown. And BLM, George Floyd, defund the police movements. Our mayor here in San Francisco, together with one of the members of our city council, said, I'm just imagining this, but the two of them said to themselves, now is the time to push for a reparations effort. So those two together did two things. This was in, I think, July or August of 2020. They first pushed for a committee. In the state, it's a task force, but in San Francisco, it was a 15-person reparations committee to create a committee. And the second thing, what the mayor did immediately, which I now am going to start investigating, is she took tens of millions of dollars away from the police department budget and put it to a project that she had just set up herself under the auspices of the mayor's office. And that was like a mini reparations kind of test to start funneling funds to underprivileged groups that are within the city, but look very much like what the reparations plan says in terms of where they were located or who would qualify to get this. So that's another topic. But so what happens is in 2020, they set up a reparations committee made up of 15 individuals. And that committee worked for a year and a half to create the plan, 60 pages, 6-0. And it gets handed over to the Board of Supervisors, our city council, for the purpose of them, the city council, reviewing the plan, debating it, saying, you know, yeah, we like it. We're going to approve the whole thing or part of it or some of the provisions, or we're going to, say no to the whole thing. And so a couple of months ago in January, and early February, that's when this report, the 60 pages, was presented to our Board of Supervisors, City Council. That then triggered the uproar because it then was public. Now we can see, and they published the 60 pages on their website. I got a hold of it, my colleagues got a hold of it, and we're like, holy effing crap, this is absolutely racist, segregationist. It's like setting up an apartheid system within San Francisco where the African-American black population are the beneficiaries and everyone else who's not black has to then give up basically everything to benefit the approximate 5% of the population of San Francisco, and the 95% of us have to pay for it, you see. So I created a website to discuss all the details in length, and that was at length, rejecttheplan.com. So I created that just a couple of months ago. And at rejecttheplan.com, you can see it's all me. It's my commentary, my analysis, my deep dive into the plan. I talk about each of the plan provisions with a reference to the page of their plan that you can look back at. So, for example, One of the provisions that they said is they want to enact a reparations tax. And then on my website, it says what page of their plan. You can see where cross-reference. I'm not just making that up. Here's the page where it's from. So I did that. I got different analysis and viewpoints. I have people that are in the legal profession were feeding me information to go and put that there. And ultimately, as the weeks were going, with this plan now being out in the open and being discussed and causing local and even national, you know, news and even outrage to a lot of people, justifiably, I then conferred with an attorney down in the LA area who is pretty well versed in state and federal constitutional law and business law and political things. And he helped me write a cease and desist. Cease and desist is not a court filing, but it could become one, where I am saying to the reparations committee, the city council, the mayor, to stop in your tracks, stop doing any work on this, because what you're doing is unlawful and unconstitutional, and you're wasting taxpayers' money on an unlawful, unconstitutional effort. So first question is, why am I, who am I to be saying this? Well, there is a specific law that is in California only. I mean, maybe other states have it, but here in the state of California is called Section 526A of the procedure, court procedure, civil procedure, where any taxpayer, anyone, can file suit against a city government, local government in this case, to have the courts enjoin them, to stop a local government from wasting taxpayers' funds on a wasteful or unlawful endeavor. And that's why I did that. So in the on the rejecttheplan.com website, I do have a copy of the cease and desist. It's I think 3 pages, and it outlines very specifically what state or federal laws, Constitution, Article this or Article that, or the Civil Rights Act, or other court precedents. It's all in there. Why the plan is unlawful, unconstitutional, illegal, and right now that cease and desist is still out there. It hasn't been canceled. And I'm waiting with my attorneys that if they try and go any further to try and push this through and actually pass anything, boom, right to court.
I have 2 quick questions.
Yes.
Did they pay, who appointed the task, like the actual people, and were they paid position?
So great question, and I actually do explain this on the website. I don't want to keep telling you to go back to the website. I know that, but this is one of the problems with this whole reparations in San Francisco, their plan. They decided to create a 15-member committee, and rather than they, meaning the Board of Supervisors, our city council, said, okay, we're going to set up a 15-member committee to now create the plan, right? So what they did not do is choose or have as a qualification exemplary, you know, leaders of industry or you know, the best legal minds or in infrastructure and business and law and all that. No, they didn't do that. What they wound up doing is they said, we want a committee of victims. So they came up with 15 levels of victimhood. One of them being, if you are incarcerated, that's it. If you're ever incarcerated, if you have to, you have to be Black, African American, a resident of San Francisco. If you've been incarcerated, come on by. We'll talk to you and we'll see if we want you. If you have been denied, everyone has to be Black. African American. I know we use it interchangeably, and the reparations plan uses the word black a lot more than African American. That's just how they're doing it. So I wind up speaking that way. So if you were ever denied a loan, come on to the committee. If you were a part of, if you grew up and went to public school between this year and that year, whatever specifics, right? And you're black and you were part of a desegregation plan, we want to talk to you. Right now, another, if you're between the ages of 14 and 24 and you work in like an after-school youth program that is mostly catering to our city's African-American kids after school, you can be on the program. So of the 15 different potential seats, they call them, on this committee, each seat had a designation of what it is. So like number 12 could have been that person who was 14 to 24. And they filled it. So you have a whole committee of basically victims. None of them are at the top of their fields, as I said earlier. So when they came up with this 60-page monstrosity of a reparations plan, it immediately is being shot down because they didn't have legal, constitutional, anyone on this committee to tell them, hey, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't create, you can't say that I want programs that are going to prioritize black housing. You can't have black credit card debt eliminated. You can't create black-run banks with a black-only credit score. These are real provisions, and so on. I try and be respectful. I try and be understandable. Understanding, but I just cannot believe they came up with so much of these. So you got to go to rejecttheplan.com and see what they have there. And you know, I don't want to laugh, but it's just incredible what they want. They basically want to segregate themselves out of the rest of San Francisco, you know, psychologically, proverbially, stay in a certain part of the southeast section of San Francisco, and like in a walled off, segregated city, black schools, black teachers, black curriculum. They want everyone who's not black to pay for all of this. They want within their school system, they want us to pay for psychologists, for therapy to help the African-American teachers now, today, deal with the white supremacist curriculum that they're being forced to have to teach today in the public schools. Listening to me saying this, I sound nuts. What I'm saying, it sounds nuts, but it is in their plan very openly, and I make reference to each page that they say it. So, what happens now is sometime next month, the reparations committee is supposed to now prepare a second version of their reparations plan. The first one is called the draft reparations plan. That's what they refer to it as, the draft reparations plan. A revised version of that is due next month to be given to the supervisors for review. I'm going to be right there getting their revised plan to see what they did, if they made it worse, who knows. And then sometime in September is when the fateful day will come and our city council is supposed to vote on it. So that's where we're at. It's exhausting.
It's funny how, and maybe this is just how I perceive it, it seems like San Francisco was like, they saw the state task force and then they were like, we can't be less than what they propose. So we're going to like go even farther off the cliff
oh, yeah.
than like the state could go. It makes the state look more sane. I mean, the whole thing is insane in general.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And on top of it, I mean, they're going to make this recommendation, but the city itself is facing what, like a $785 million deficit. It's probably going to balloon up to like $1.3 billion. So these numbers they're throwing out there for like $5 million per citizen, it's just ludicrous. It's not realistic. It's never going to happen. If it did happen, it would definitely put San Francisco farther in the hole than it is. Yeah. I want to kind of like touch upon that. Like when we had our episode about San Francisco a couple weeks ago, the main topic was, should we let San Francisco just fail because it's overextended itself. It's has this huge deficit. It's probably has programs it can't pay for. Talk a little bit about that. It, like the state of what San Francisco is looking at in terms of their own budget and the economy right now.
So, it reminds me, that kind of question is similar to what you hear about the banks, you know, years ago. It's too big to fail, right? We can't let it fail. Or it won't fail because it's too big. San Francisco is a mess. You know, it's this swirling, whirling cesspool of political shit. I mean, it's such a mess. And because there's such a division between the farthest left progressive, but you can't even call it progressive. They're like Marxists. These people are like petulant children running around, communists playing. I don't know what they think that they're doing compared to everybody else who's trying to hold the city back from falling over a cliff. Okay. So you have a budget. You have a required amount of money to run the city with all the programs. You've got a lower and lower amount of revenues that are coming in. And so you kind of have three choices. One is to cut back on the programs to make it meet what the revenues are coming in. The second one is to raise revenues. The third option is a hybrid of both. Okay. The problem is that our city hall leaders, for the most part, don't want to cut back on any of the programs at all. They don't want to trim the fat. They don't want to find where to cut. I mean, they're going to have to. They know that. They're not sure where, and we're waiting to hear what they're planning on doing. But instead, they're trying to find more revenue sources, which means whatever ineffective, wasteful programs that are dealing with drug addiction, homelessness, mental illness, and all that just wasted funds is not going to get cut. They're not going to cut giving the taxpayers' money to these ridiculous, unaccountable nonprofits that are ruining our city streets. And instead, they're doing things like trying to raise taxes. And I'm sure, because this year we don't have an election, it was postponed. Next year we're going to have in March the primary, and then in November is the general, along with the presidential, right? So they're going to try and put on as many tax increases, property tax increases, other taxes, to try and pay for what is already a horrendously high budget. So there's the problem. The problem is they are not willing to cut back any programs, and it's going to squeeze the locals here, the taxpayers, worse and worse. So that's why many businesses have figured, the big businesses said, it's no longer economically feasible for us to be here anymore. Beyond the issues of the homeless crisis, the tent dwellers and the people shooting up right outside the front doors of our stores. And I mean, we're at like 22 or 23 major known retailers have shut and left or are about to, you know, and the tech companies, you know, they're the ones who are getting the brunt of a lot of blame, saying, well, you know, you started this, you're the ones that caused all of this. So You know, that's not true, really, about the tech companies. They're everyone's part of it. And is it going to fail? Well, it could in certain aspects, certain industries. Yeah, it could. The budget right now is $14.3 billion. Our city is 7 miles by 7 miles. So think about where you live in Orange County or in San Diego. How far, where, what is 7 miles square? 7 miles by 7 miles, right? That's how big San Francisco is. That's it. We are on the tip of a peninsula. We're surrounded by water on three sides. So we can't move anywhere. We can't expand. We don't have any, you know, outskirts. It's a different counties. So that's what we have. 49 square miles, 7 miles by 7 miles. And within it, we have about 800,000 people. And our budget is $14.3 billion. When I ran for office the first time years ago, it was only $6.8 billion. So it's more than doubled just in these few years. And a lot of it, yeah, a lot of it is due to the fact that we have a very large payroll. Like one of the largest employers is the government, the city of San Francisco itself. There's tens of thousands of employees that work for San Francisco, with, you know, the unions, high hourly wages, very high benefit programs, and a high pension. So that, I believe, the last time I looked, that takes up like $5.5 billion of the $14 billion. So if you say, okay, $14.3 billion is the budget for the city, let's cut that down. Let's cut it down to $9 billion. Then you don't leave much to run, because so much of it is the city government itself, all the different departments and you know, everything there, rec and parks and human services and the police department, everything is at least $5 billion out of that. And they're not going to want to cut back. They're not going to want to, you know, say we're going to half our budget. So we are in a very dire situation. And will it fail? It can fail, but what does that mean? What's that going to look like? It's going to look like we are hunkered down in our homes, whether we own them or rent our homes, apartments or houses. We're paying the taxes that keep it going, keep the city going. There'll be shortfalls. And then they'll probably start defaulting on any of the city loans, any of the city bond measures, the payments. They won't be able to pay on that. The credit rating goes down. They can't borrow more money. They'll have to put all these big projects on hold. And then we're all going to start suffering. The school systems, the infrastructure. So we're going to have to really tighten our belts. Otherwise, we're in trouble.
Yeah, how do you even attack, like, the problem with that many city governments and pensions is these are promises, I guess, made to people for working, and they said, okay, well, I'm going to work in this government job and I'm going to get a nice pension. How do you even tackle an issue like that where people are promised a certain amount of money and you can't really cut back on it? So how do you tackle
that? Well, there are a few ways, but, you know, any attempt to play around with the city's earnings, the salaries, the pensions, is like, you know, they can attack you. You know, I understand in LA this was an issue a few years ago, and at the mayoral debates, they were all asked this question. So what has to happen is you have to now create categories of city employees. Those that have been around for a long time that signed on and got employed with this kind of benefit package, then anyone new that comes on board as of today has a drastically different benefit package. So you may have same employees working in similar departments, maybe even working, you know, shoulder to shoulder, but they have different benefit packages because it depends on their seniority, how long they've been there, and under what benefit program they were hired. So they're going to have to cut back on that. That's the first thing. The second thing is the possibility is to ask for early retirement, saying we can't, you know, in employ you anymore. We're doing like a mandatory layoff, a mandatory furloughing, and then we can bring you back, but it might be in a different category. And this actually happened in 2008, 2009, when we had the mortgage meltdown and all that back in those years there. What the city did is in many of the departments around the city, they said, okay, everybody, you're all laid off, and we're going to bring you all back with a different category or name or title, job description or job number designation. And you kind of like have to come back on and choose your new designation, and you have to audition for it, and you'll have a different employment package. You're still, you know, you haven't lost your position as a permanent or part-time city employee, but now you're in a different designation, and that will have a different the benefits and your retirement. So that's a way to do it. I know it's long-winded, but that's how a way you can do that without just saying everybody out. But it's slow. It's a slow process, and because the unions are involved and they're going to, you know, really push back, I don't know if it push comes to shove, whether or not the unions themselves would rather see the city go bankrupt and collapse than to make negotiations on their employees or pensions. So that's really drastic. You know, we'll see. We don't want to see, but yeah, we'll see.
It's just, I guess, in a city that loves the idea that the government solves everything and the government is all knowing and powerful.
Yeah.
It's, I guess it's hard to think that San Francisco, those in power, and I feel like London Bree's got a little bit more moderate as reality has hit her office, but she's still, and moderate, she's gotten more moderate compared to what she was. She's still super far left, but it's just hard to think that in a city that loves government solutions to government, to all these problems, to ask them, okay, we have to cut back and we have to cut back the government, as opposed to, well, we'll just tax people more because the government is all knowing and all powerful. It just seems like that's, and with declining revenue and declining businesses, it just seems like San Francisco really is in for like a doom loop scenario.
So if you look at the results of the recall of DHS of Bodine, the map, the Department of Elections and other political analysts were able to come up with a map. And again, San Francisco is a square, 7 miles by 7 miles. It's easy to look at with all the different districts and neighborhoods, right? They came up with a map that shows who voted for recalling Chesa Bodine and who opposed the recall, who wanted to keep him in. And so in the center, it's a kind of like a donut. In the center area were those that were staunchly against his recall. That's where he had the most support, were in the center of the donut hole. All around the outside, it's still San Francisco, but it feels more suburban-y. And that's where I live. I'm on the northwest, the upper left corner of that donut on the map, near the Presidio, as you said. So we all voted to recall him, and we won. More of us on the periphery of the donut voted more moderate, more pro law and order. The ones in the center, the neighborhoods there, parts of the Mission, parts of the area of Noe Valley and other areas, if it rings a bell, they voted to keep him in. So that's where the staunchest, most radical people are. Of course, you know, all around there are, you know, the extreme leftists, But our challenge is to ensure that that donut, the hole doesn't grow. And it's not like we can prevent people from moving in. We can't erect a wall. I'm not suggesting that we put a wall around the donut hole, but you know, it's just very interesting to see that those who were the most open to recalling were the ones that were the most pro law and order, of course, but are family oriented. A lot are immigrants or children or families with immigrant parents. We have a large Russian population. We have a very well known large Asian Chinese population. And then everyone else that just has families with young kids. So we're all the ones that voted in a much more moderate way. I don't want to say conservative because that's not really correct, but a more moderate, pro-merit, pro-law and order, pro-safety, pro-clean streets, pro-accountability in City Hall. So we're the ones that are now driving the conversation now. It used to be the most radical leftists, but the problem is nationally, the media are listening to the loudest voices of the furthest left because they're the ones that yell and scream and have tantrums and thumb sucking, you know, they're wetting their beds because they don't want this, they don't want that. They're the ones who are getting the attention of the media, but they're not the ones who are driving us actual voters. So it's going to be very interesting to see. You know, we were supposed to have elections this November. We were supposed to have elections for mayor, DA, sheriff, I think the treasurer was it, and the sheriff. We were supposed to have five key City Hall positions. The mayor and DA, that's a big deal. London Breed and the new DA, Brooke Jenkins, were supposed to be up for election this November, along with whatever ballot measures would have been proposed along with it and just thrown on a ballot, right? But they put a ballot measure last year in November to say, we want to delay November's elections for a year and move it to 2024, November 2024. So that would be on the same ballot as the presidential and the governor and all of those. We fought against it saying, why do you want to do this? What's the purpose for doing that? Why do you want to delay democracy? They say, well, it's going to make more democracy because now it's going to be with all the other. No, it's not more democracy. You've just moved it. So you've canceled democracy. So anyway, our side lost, meaning no matter how hard we fought it, for some reason, voters, it was like 66, 33, whatever percent. Yeah, let's move it. So now we have no elections this year. It was supposed to be, but it's not. So now we are still stuck with our mayor and no ballot measures until the end of next year. We have a year and a half to wait.
Wow.
No elections, canceled. Yeah.
In the name of democracy.
You're speechless. As long
as you say it's in the name of democracy. Yeah. So was that donut hole just absolutely filled with, red MAGA hat wearing Trump Republicans? That donut hole, because that's, I'm sure, how you were painted if you voted against Chesa Boudin. And I want to talk about that real quick as we're coming up on the hour.
I can't believe how fast the time has gone.
Yeah. I know. Time flies when you're having fun. There's so much we want to talk about. We'll just have to have you come back on and do a second episode.
No problem.
Oh, I have so many questions.
Okay.
The one thing I want, so you were integral in recalling Chesa Boudin. Now we have Brooke Jenkins in. Mm-hmm. Has the situation with crime improved in San Francisco, or how is that going in San Francisco right now with crime?
So it goes much more than removing Chesa Boudin, that fraud of a fake DA, because he infiltrated the criminal justice system. It wasn't just him. It was also the people that were on staff in the district attorney's office who he brought over from the defense side. So it was a whole mess. And also not just that, there's also existing Chesa Boudin loyalists, those who agree with his and any of the Soros mentality, anti-prosecution prosecutors that are in City Hall. And so that includes some of the judges, the local judges. It includes some of the city councilmen. It includes our police commission that has the oversight of the police department. And they are pretty much anti-cop as well, believe it or not. The police commission is anti-cop. So we can't really have a clean slate fixing everything until all of that is taken care of. But the chief law enforcement officer now, Brooke Jenkins, yes, she is actually prosecuting now, but we can't open the floodgates and arrest everyone that should have been arrested and all bring them in for prosecution because they don't have the staff. They don't have – the police department is in a shambles, as we hear in all over the country is its problem. And they don't have the personnel to be able to just do a, you know, pick up 1,000, 2,000 criminals and just start processing them. They can't do that. It would just overload the courts, overload the jail, all of that. That would be mass incarceration, right? And what is happening though is there is a very big change now in the fact that we have an actual prosecutor behind the helm of the DA's office. And there is a change, but the problem is we still have those Chesa Boudin loyalists that are still around.
Have you cared to vote about until November 2024?
Correct.
Now, I did read that Brooke Jenkins was getting
an extra year.
And she was getting rid of a bunch of the staff.
Yep.
And switching over to people who actually want to prosecute. But like, as far as elections, now that's all delayed a year.
Right. Yeah. So whether or not she likes it, whether or not the mayor, London Breed, is happy about it or not, they're both in it for an extra unelected year. They didn't have to campaign for it. They just got it. You know, so London Breed now is going to be in for 5 years instead of four. Now she's going to run for re-election next year. So she'll be in for quite a while. Will she make it? Will she be re-elected? Right now, she's in bad shape. So we'll see.
Do you think she'll be beaten by somebody farther left than her?
No, because looking at what happened with Chesa Boudin, and as I said before, with the donut hole, that we now have that movement where we, the centrists, are a greater voting pack than the farthest leftist, Marxist, socialist, bedwetting, whatever you want to call it. You know? So the thing is, we're now hoping for someone that is to her right. That doesn't mean extremist right, because she has been slipping further left, further left, further left, little by little, to where many of the things that she's been doing, she's just inept and supporting drug dealers in some aspects. She's trying to skirt federal and state laws and doing the opening the safe injection sites. That's a far left idea. That's not centrist. That's not moderate. So anyone that is going to come in and come up with a nice slate of proposals could potentially beat her from the right without being a MAGA Republican, which has no chance here.
Would you consider running again?
Yes. Yes, I will. Okay. But will I is a different question. But
you'll consider it.
I already made promises to people that I wouldn't. but the pressure is mounting. And right now I'm enjoying just like relaxing, doing a lot of commentary on I hear on a podcast or on TV. They bring me on often to just say what I think. I'm enjoying wearing flip-flops and shorts. I'm enjoying not shaving. Right now I'm having fun. We'll see what happens in a year from now. The deadline to file to be a candidate to run for office is June of next year. So there's still a little over a year. But that would be cutting it short because people are already now declaring. Someone 3 weeks ago, a city council person already declared that he's challenging Mayor London Breed, but he's to the left of her.
Okay. Wow. I brought this up last week. I had done a live on Instagram, just kind of ranting about stuff. And I had a conversation with a good friend of ours who lives up there in Pacifica and she loves San Francisco. That's her city. She just loved going there and all that. And we were having a conversation and we knew politically she doesn't align with my wife and I. We had always imagined she was much farther left than us. And somehow we got on the topic and she said, you know what? I'm a registered Democrat, but at this point, I don't care if they're Democrat, Republican, or independent. I look at what happened in San Francisco and I just want someone who can get stuff done and fix all these problems. And I think to your point with the donut hole, there's probably a bunch of voters in San Francisco who are looking for that common sense. Hey, let's get back to basics. Let's get back to just running the city properly, making everyone feel safe, enjoying the city, and forget about all the other stuff. So I think there's probably a big platform for that.
Well, that's how it should be. You know, technically, legality-wise, city positions are nonpartisan. So when you fill out the paperwork as a candidate, you don't put in what your party affiliation is. So it's not a Democratic running against the Republican in a runoff. No, it's just it's open. But people are proud to say that they're a Democrat when they're running and they put it in their advertising. If anyone said, I'm a proud Republican, that's it. You're Trump, and that's it. And you're done. You're anti-abortion. You're anti this, pro this, pro that. Just link to Trump, and you're dead in the water. You might as well just pack up and leave. And that's what happens. That's how anyone gets attacked. You just say you're Trump. You're Trumpish. Yeah. Whatever word you want to say. And you're sunk.
Yeah. Well, this has been an amazing conversation, as I was expecting. Definitely, door is open for you to come back on. We may have to have you come back on and check in more about San Francisco for us down here in Southern California. Where can people find you or follow you or what you're up to and learn more about you if they want to reach out to you?
Okay, so as we were talking about the reparations plan specifically, I have the website rejecttheplan.com. And you can, there's a wealth of information, and it's getting updated as more and more comes out about that crazy plan. I'm on Twitter, very active. And at rejecttheplan.com, you can see the link to my Twitter account. You guys follow me, so you can see RichieSF2016. And you can engage with me or see what I'm ranting about. But then my personal website, which just gives a little bit more about me and my media appearances and things like my positions. That's my name, .org, richiegreenberg.org. So R-I-C-H-I-E, Greenberg is all E's, G-R-E-E-N-B-E-R-G, richiegreenberg.org. And you can always send an email to me, and I'm happy to respond. You can follow me on Twitter and ask questions. I can respond. So that's it. I don't really do anything on any other social media. So it's Twitter and my website. So that's it. But yeah, it was a pleasure to be here. Really, really thankful that I have platforms to be able to talk to anyone that wants to hear from the belly of the beast here in San Francisco.
Thank you.
Well, we were happy to have you.
That flew by.
Yeah, thank you. Like, yeah, we'll definitely schedule you for another podcast soon to check in. And maybe, who knows, maybe down the road we'll be checking in with you as a mayoral candidate for San Francisco. I don't know. I'm just saying it. Maybe. But thanks for coming on, Richie. And make sure everyone to go follow him on Twitter. He's a great Twitter follower. And as always, as I end every show, if you want to help support the show, the best thing you can do that's free and the least amount of effort is go share this with somebody, especially people in San Francisco who are dealing with these issues and need to hear a voice of reason go check out this episode, share it with people. And with that, have a good night, everybody.